You're listening to 15 Minutes with a Mensch. I'm Bill Batstone. This episode's Mensch is Susan Friedberg Kelsen, CEO of the Squirrel Hill Health Center and chair of the Commission on Social Action of Reformed Judaism. Now, I want to start by saying this. I'm very aware that the title of the podcast is 15 Minutes with a Mensch, implying that an episode will start and end within 15 minutes. However, what I'm quickly learning in this podcast journey that I'm on is that sometimes you find individuals so interesting, with such a story to tell, that you want to listen to whatever they have to say. And I could easily make an episode 60 minutes or even longer. This was definitely my experience in visiting with Susan. In my opinion, it is impossible not to hear her speak about items like social justice, equality in healthcare, and serving a marginalized population on a daily basis, and not find yourself inspired to take action. So while this episode is closer to maybe 25 or 30 minutes with a mensch as opposed to 15, I can guarantee that it is worth every single minute. If you would like more information on what Susan discusses during this episode, be sure to check out the following websites: squirrelhillhealthcenter.org, rac.org, that's RAC.org, and URJ.org. All right, Susan, well, thanks for joining me this evening. I'm so happy to get to spend some time with you and talk about all the things you're involved in and a little bit about your journey. And so thanks for making some time.
It's my pleasure. I'm really grateful that you invited me.
So, Susan, why don't you start by just telling us a little bit about yourself? I did a little bit of an intro, but there's so much there to unpack. So tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and what you're involved in now.
Well, I am a native Pittsburgher. I'm actually the third of what is now six generations of Pittsburgh Jewish family, married into a family that has a similar lineage. And I'm a lifelong member of Road of Shalom, a very proud lifelong member of Road of Shalom. And I like to think of myself as a real Pittsburgher because I left several times saying I was never going to live in Pittsburgh and ended up coming back. And the last and lasting time was with my husband, David. We were ready to have a family and we were living in New York. And we decided, you know what, we want our children to grow up near our parents and our extended family. Let's try to move back to Pittsburgh. So we did that. It's now many, many, many years ago. And it turned out to be one of the best decisions that we've ever made. We've had fulfilling lives here, professionally and personally, and the opportunity to raise our children at Road of Shalom and in this really pretty amazing community that we have here.
So, Susan, can you tell us a little bit about your role at the Squirrel Hill Health Center? I know you're obviously involved over there, so tell us a little bit about that, too.
Well, I have been fortunate enough to be the CEO of Squirrel Hill Health Center since before we opened in 2006. Squirrel Hill Health Center is what's called a federally qualified health center. It's a nonprofit community health center that was created by Pittsburgh's Jewish community, actually, to provide primary and preventive medical, behavioral health, and dental care to everyone who needs it, regardless of insurance status or ability to pay. So we're completely independent, nonprofit. We're not part of the Jewish agencies. We're not faith-based at all, but we live very comfortably in the Jewish community as well as in other communities. And one of the reasons we were created was really to provide high quality health services for immigrants and refugees and people who were members of minority religious groups whose faith might affect their ability to get high quality care, particularly in the Muslim community and the Orthodox Jewish community. So those were sort of some of the original ideas. As we evolved, growing year over year over year, we really became deeply interwoven in Pittsburgh's diverse immigrant and refugee community. There were almost no new refugees coming to the area when we first opened, and not a lot of immigrants either, but there turned out to be what was then a hidden Latino population, very much sort of tucked away out of sight. And we had staff members who were fluent in Spanish, and word got out and we started providing care to members of the Latino community. And that was kind of what got us rolling. We started just with medical services. We had a little office on the ground floor of Charles Morris Nursing Home, which really complicated things because we weren't a geriatric center and we weren't a Jewish agency, and there we were, and nobody could see us from the street. And right after we opened, they stopped running buses to the campus. And it was just sort of a comedy of errors. But I'm a lawyer by training, and I had never done anything like this. And the beauty of that was that every day, with wonderful, wonderful partners, including Dr. Andrea Fox, who is still our chief medical officer, and also our founding CFO, Barbara Johnson, who's since retired, we got to go into work and make up what we were going to do that day. And always with a focus on how we were really going to provide good care for people who most needed it. So that was our challenge. And we started evolving. We added behavioral health services in 2007, integrated behavioral health services, before that was even a thing. It's now such a thing that we receive separate federal funding to support it. Mm-hmm. And we are supported through a federal grant. We're part of a national program of federally qualified health centers, each one independent, 1,400 separate independent organizations, all receiving base federal funding to provide these kinds of services to nearly 30 million underserved residents of the United Wow. States. So we are actually one of the largest, the largest network of primary care providers in the nation. And as I said, we started to grow. We added behavioral health services. We added prenatal services because women were coming to us who were unable to get prenatal care. They didn't have insurance. They would go to one of the hospital systems and be asked to pay up front money that they didn't have, and therefore they were going without prenatal care. So when we saw this happening, we just decided we got to figure this out. And we did, and we got wonderful private funding to support that, which has continued to this day. Because we are, the federal funding doesn't cover everything. We get revenue for insured patients. We see insured patients, uninsured patients. Medicaid is our biggest subgroup, Medicaid insured patients, and Medicare. And we have a sliding fee scale for people with no insurance so that we offer services at a rate that people can afford. And if they can't afford it, we never send the bill collector after anybody. So there's a nominal fee, but we waive that if circumstances warrant it. So that's how we started to grow. We started getting more funding. There started to be more immigrants. There started to be refugees coming. Yeah. We started to get really involved with particularly JFNCS, which was then one of only two refugee resettlement agencies. And we started seeing every newly arriving refugee in Allegheny County. And then there were more refugees, and there were more refugee resettlement agencies, and we were still seeing almost everyone who was coming through 2017. At the peak, we saw over 700 new refugees in 1 year. Wow. That was in 2016. And then it just dropped precipitously, and I'm pleased that it's going to pick up again. We have, as I said, very diverse patient population. The second language of our patients after English is Nepali, which is the language of the Bhutanese Nepali refugee community. We moved to a bigger space, but we added dental in 2011, moved everybody into the same space on Browns Hill Road in 2012, opened a second site in Brentwood in 2015 because there were a lot of refugees in that community. And before the pandemic, we had 2019, we were seeing about 8,000 individual patients in about 32,000 face-to-face visits a year, including, as I said, medical, behavioral health, and dental, pediatrics, neonatal, and prenatal through geriatrics, and also using a mobile medical unit to reach people who are too isolated to find their way to a doctor on their own.
Wow. I mean, it's incredible. And hearing you tell those stories and just the population you've served, the numbers, truly, I don't know if they surprised me. Maybe it's just because, you know, I didn't realize there were that many refugees in the Pittsburgh area, right? I mean, it's just one of those things that I haven't stopped to really think about.
Yeah. And the Bhutanese community has really thrived here. And I've heard varying numbers, up to 10,000 residents now. And we're a health home, or what's called a certified patient-centered medical home. We provide all these comprehensive wraparound services, care coordination, care navigation, we call it, intensive interpretation. We hire from the communities we serve. We have lab services on site. We try to eliminate as many barriers as we can. And so we keep patients over time. It's not just that we see new people or new refugees and then they disappear, or new anybody. We take care of a lot of, you know, American-born patients. We take care of Pittsburghers. We have a home visit program for homebound patients. We take care of Pittsburghers who are literally in now homebound in the homes that they were born in.
Right.
So, you know, it is just this wonderful, diverse group of people. We keep adapting and adding services as times change. Our most recent pre-pandemic service, I think dating back to 2018, if I'm remembering correctly, is we now offer medicated assisted treatment for opioid addiction. Mm-hmm. And we did it as a pilot, and we really, again, kind of made it up. Yeah. We studied best practices. We met all the certification requirements, but we decided we were going to integrate it fully into our primary care and existing behavioral health practice to reduce stigma, to make it easy to get care, and to normalize a medical, the process of caring for a chronic condition. Yeah. And that's been a small but very successful program that I'm really proud of.
Yeah, definitely. So, and you touch on, I mean, all the work you do with so many minority groups and groups that are somewhat marginalized by society or are marginalized by society. And I know you've also been really involved in the Religious Action Center of Reform Judaism as well. So Can you talk a little bit about that experience? Because I think that's an also a really fascinating kind of parallel life you live.
Well, I'm crazy enough to sort of have two full-time jobs at the moment. But also just so honored. I've been involved originally as a member of, I still am a member of the North American Board of the Union for Reform Judaism. I got involved on what's called the Commission on Social Action. And the Commission on Social Action is an entity that is a mix of lay leaders and rabbinic leaders from all over North America who oversee the work of the Religious Action Center in Washington, D.C., and now in many states as well. So the Religious Action Center is the Reform Movement's advocacy arm and social justice arm. It has been around for about 60 years, has a proud history in the civil rights movement. Really, its birth was out of the civil rights movement in the 1950s, has been led by just remarkable people. Currently led by Rabbi Jonah Pesner, and previously by Rabbi David Saperstein, and has served as this conscience of the Reform movement in many ways, I would say. The entity through which not only our advocacy is done, but policy, particularly on issues of social justice, is set. So the commission has about 120 members, again, representatives of congregations all over North America, rabbis, and then also representatives of a lot of other entities in the reform constellation. So NIFTY, the youth group, the youth movement has representation, temple educators and administrators and cantors, as well as rabbis, all men of Reform Judaism and women of Reform Judaism all have representation on the Commission on Social Action. And at the end of 2019, I had the enormous privilege of being elected as chair of the Commission on Social Action, which I have to say is one of the things that means the most to me, aside from family and of course my work. But in my day job, I get to live the work of social justice through healthcare in a secular environment, this incredibly diverse secular environment. In my role with the Commission on Social Action, I get to live those same values through an overtly Jewish lens. Everything I do in my life is guided by my Jewish values and my sense of being a Jew and what our role as Jews should be in the world. But it's the commission where that can be expressed most fully.
So I want to talk just, I mean, you hit, it's an unbelievable, every time I talk to people who are involved in these types of things, it's unbelievably inspiring to hear you tell your story and listen to your journey and what you're passionate about. It makes me want to get involved in these types of things as well. But one of the questions I always ask guests is, can you tell us a story or one or two rewarding experiences, things that really stick out in your mind when you look back through this life that you've led and all the different things you've been involved in, one or two things that really stick out, and if you would be willing to share those with us.
Sure. I think there are three things that sort of leap to mind, and it kind of covers an arc. Right after we opened Squirrel Hill House Center, when we were kind of struggling because we were hidden and we were sort of finding our way, the Post-Gazette ran a feature story about us and our grand opening. And it ran in the Sunday paper. And the very next morning when we came into the office, there was a woman waiting on our doorstep. And she has permitted me to tell this story over the years. I'm not going to say who it was. But it turned out, and she was holding the newspaper. She was standing there holding that story. She was born in the former Soviet Union. She and her husband and their two young children basically were, although they weren't officially refugees, when the Soviet Union collapsed, they were homeless and stateless. They were ethnic Russians whose families had lived in one of the Soviet states that was no longer a part of Russia. And so she was a physician and her husband was a mathematician. They lost their jobs. They had nowhere to go. They were just adrift. And he had gotten a postdoc in Pittsburgh, and they were here on his student visa, and she was not permitted to work. And she had a sick child, and she didn't know what to do. And there she was. They became our patients. She became a member of our board. Ultimately, although she couldn't practice medicine in this country because the boards for people who were educated abroad are extraordinarily difficult, she went back to school and she'd been a neurologist and she became a neurology physician's assistant. And her husband got a job, her kids graduated from college, and I'm still in touch with her. And recently, after Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, she gave me a print that is a picture of Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Wow.
because she said it made her think of Squirrel Hill House Center. She's not Jewish. She knew some of my story. And to know that the work that we are doing together, because this is a collective effort, makes that kind of a difference in somebody's life is profound. So that's the big story.
Wow.
I'll just tell one URJ story.
Sure.
I could leave it there. I don't know. Sure. Maybe that stands alone. But one of the really gratifying moments for me in my work with the URJs, in 2017, I was the chair of the resolutions committee for the URJ biennial that year. And we brought forward a resolution on the rights of transgender people. And it had taken a lot of work. And at that time, no faith-based organization had taken a stand. And I had the privilege of presenting it to this group of that year. I think there were 6,000 participants. And there was a little bit of debate on the floor. And then there was a vote. And then there was a roar and a standing ovation as we passed that resolution. And it actually, there were reporters from, not just from North America, but from Europe as well. And it appeared in English newspapers. And we can affect change. When we think of people as individuals, when we see the humanity in every person, when we recognize that whatever your religious beliefs, that we are all created in the image of the divine, we can make change happen. We can help improve people's lives. And when we do that, we get to live a life that is incredibly rewarding.
And with that, I mean, that's, again, almost speechless. That's why I'm not necessarily a great podcast host, because I love listening more than sometimes I like talking. With that in mind, I mean, I know some people may be familiar with, you know, the Commission on Social Action, and some people might be familiar with some of the work you're doing, and some people might be listening to this and learning for the first time. And so I know one of the big things right now, when you talk about affecting change, one of the big efforts right now is on the racial justice campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk just a little bit about what that involves? And
I
know it seems like a ridiculous question of, like, why should people be interested or why should people care in 2021? But I want to hear straight from you. What is it involved in, and why should people be paying attention?
Thank you. Thanks for letting me put a plug in. So the racial justice campaign, well, I'm going to go back just a year. As the URJ has evolved, and particularly as we have moved through pandemic times, we've decided to focus our efforts on a single overarching campaign each year. Coming out of the Religious Action Center, but engaging the entire movement. This is not, we are breaking down these sort of artificial distinctions between what happens through social justice and the religious action movement and what happens around North America and in our congregations. So in 2020, we had a very successful civic engagement campaign, completely nonpartisan, designed to make sure that everybody had the opportunity to vote and the opportunity to participate in the presidential election, who was eligible to vote. And we engaged tens of thousands of members of our congregations, and they engaged something like hundreds of thousands of voters, and it was successful. It was a way to get Reform Jews involved. As Reform Jews, saying that we value democracy and we value our ability to exercise the right to vote, we value it not just for ourselves, but for others as well. And as we were heading into 2021, and of course, very much living in the turmoil and upheaval of the last year around civil rights and social justice, we not me, but a large group of lay and professional leaders, started examining what we should be doing for 2021. And the obvious answer was a racial justice campaign. This is a deep part of our history as Reformed Jews. We're justifiably proud of work that the movement did with incredible rabbinic and lay leadership in the 50s and 60s around civil rights. But that's a moment in time, and the world has moved on, sometimes in very painful and difficult ways. And I think, I'm sure everyone listening to this knows that there have been deep and incredibly difficult fractures in the relationships between Jews and African Americans, particularly. We have always worked through the Commission on Social Justice to find allies and work together in partnership, in true partnership, with other social justice organizations across faiths, across identities. So that was a piece of it. There's this movement happening in the streets of our country, and we feel that we have a religious voice to add to that movement. The other thing that's happening is change within our movement. Despite what it may feel like for many of us who are white Ashkenazi Jews, the American Jewish population is much more diverse and increasingly diverse than that stereotypical white Ashkenazi background. And the Reform movement is the most diverse of all the movements. Mm-hmm. And we need to make sure that every member of our Jewish community, every member of our movement, everyone who is not a member of our movement but identifies as a Jew who has an affinity to our practices and beliefs and values, has a place and a role and a voice. And not to tell people what they should be doing, but to listen and to learn and to embrace our own diversity and the richness of the many backgrounds that now nourish us and sustain us as a movement. So it's both the work of external racial justice and internal. And so there's something for everybody to do. So I think the question of why we should care about living in a just and equitable society. To me, that's just the baseline. That's how I was raised. That's how my parents were raised. And my husband, his parents. I mean, it is just people deserve to be treated justly. And we should care because there is a deep history of systemic racism in American society that many of us have benefited from inadvertently. I'm not saying that we have intended to benefit from it. But I always say I was born lucky. You know, I was born into a comfortable household. I had educational opportunities. And I also now really understand that I move through the world with white skin, even though my identity as a Jew often feels very marginalized and threatened. So it's complex. And we should care about trying to help right some of those wrongs for everybody, for our children, in my case, for my grandchild, so that the world that we leave behind us is a little better, not a little worse than the one we were born into. And then as Reformed Jews, we should care because we should be embracing the opportunity to nurture and enrich and sustain our congregations and our movement and our values and our families. So to me, that's enough reasons, I guess.
Yeah. Well, that's, I mean, really well said. And I really liked what you said earlier about it being kind of the conscience of the Reform movement, right? And helping kind of guide that, those decisions, yeah, and that advocacy piece. And I know that the racial justice campaign, obviously extremely important, especially at this time. And I think you did a great job of describing why people should care, but that's not the only area of advocacy. And I know there's other ones as well. So I know there's, you know, obviously there's some separation of the church and state, and I know there's healthcare and economic justice. Yep. Can you just touch base on kind of other areas that are currently being explored? And I know the advocacy doesn't always just stop and start with one thing, but can you just want to touch on that for a little bit?
Absolutely. And by the way, all the things you mentioned are all interwoven.
So, right.
Because that's often the case in justice work, social justice work. Well, first of all, I want to say that there is advocacy at many levels. The Religious Action Center was once really just focused on Washington, even though our movement includes Canadian Jews. It's a North American movement, Mexicans. But it was all about Washington. And over the years, with gridlock in Washington, we've been forced to spread out, and we now have state RACs in 8 states, the newest of which is Pennsylvania, this past year. So there are now and will be increasing opportunities for ROTF members to participate in advocacy, not just at a federal level, but at a state level and a local level through RAC PA. So that's my plug. And yes, you are right. We have decades of policy statements going back 100 years now on issues of importance to us as Reformed Jews, many of which have remained completely relevant. Fair treatment of women, labor law, fair labor laws, economic justice, criminal justice, environmental justice. We are very focused on the environment. There are ways to get involved on that issue. We do work on immigration and refugees. Again, based on our own history as a people, how can we not care when we know what it was like to be, you know, cast asunder or fleeing for our lives? And so there are lots of different ways to get involved. Healthcare is another, women's reproductive rights is another. And when I say they intersect, it's because, you know, as you've picked up on, I said we're maybe the conscience of the movement. Maybe we're nudges too. be a little bit of a prodding.
Yeah.
These issues don't always make people comfortable. And that's okay. And not everybody has to agree. There is room enough for diversity of opinion, which is something that I think often gets lost. But part of the role of the Commission on Social Action is to do deep dives into subjects, to listen to and learn from and study a variety of viewpoints on any given issue, and then arrive at consensus on what we believe the policy of the movement should be, that then has to be adopted either at biennial by all the participants or through the board as the representatives of the movement. And there is room for divergent viewpoints. We are often seen as very far to the left, and certainly we espouse progressive values, and in the social justice work, we do espouse progressive values. That does not mean that there is not room for people with differing viewpoints to be heard in a respectful manner and to learn from each other. I've learned so much from hearing differing viewpoints. And so there's a place for everybody. And the work that we do is not partisan. It is not political in that sense. It is about those values of justice and equity for everybody.
Yeah, it's not political, but it's certainly people focused, right? It's about people. And
it is about people and how we live the society, how we all move through society together.
Yeah.
And whether everybody has access to the same opportunities.
So if people are listening to this and they're as inspired as I am, because I'm going to find, my wife will be thrilled knowing there's a Pennsylvania chapter and we can get involved.
Yes.
And we will certainly, yes, be a part of that for sure.
Yes.
So if people are interested in getting more information or they want to get involved, where can they go and what would you recommend?
So check out the website, check out the urj.org and rac.org. The Pennsylvania RAC does not have its own website. But I can share information on how to connect with the work that's being done. There's a leadership committee that is setting agendas, and I would love nothing more than for my own congregation to jump into this work. I know that there's a social action committee at RODF, and I think that's wonderful. There's also work room for advocacy work on this level. And it would be great if folks who want to do it get together, and I would be more than happy to introduce you to the staff person from the RAC who is leading RAC PA and the lay leaders who are involved.
That would be excellent. Well, Susan, I really appreciate your time, and obviously I think everybody who listens to this is going to be inspired to do this work. So just credit to you for all the work that you do, your day job, your night job, your weekend job, all the different jobs that you have. Thank you for this work. And it was a real pleasure getting a chance to spend some time with you.
It's been wonderful talking to you. Thank you for being interested. I really appreciate the opportunity. And I hope everybody out there is safe and well and vaccinated.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. Thank you. Fifteen Minutes with a Mensch is a podcast supported by the Prayer, Practice, and Learning Committee of Deaf Shalom Congregation in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. For more information on upcoming events or how you can get involved, visit our website at www.rodefshalom.org. I'm Bill Battistone.